Okay. So, well, I'd like to hear more about that list. Why is it beginning in 1780?
Because John Hall from Bristol settles in Annapolis County.
It's the family tree. I see what you mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right. So, talking. Now, here's the thing. When Andrew says that I can't understand how people got Marshall so wrong, Andrew's missing the fact that it's an information overload society. Celebrities and names are coming and going. Most people never even heard Marshall, and those that did would seem indifferent. You have to look at the circumstances that the poem was written in. Marshall's poem, his action. Nobody knew anything about anybody. You got a media society that's making up stuff about everybody, like the National Enquirer, even in the more responsible levels of media. And nobody had time to take anything in.
Yeah, I guess the other thing is that sentence is a little bit true. If you think about a certain number of people, the critic in mind that really comes to mind is James Carey. Now, James Carey was probably the figure that was most parroted, I think, in terms of his criticism of McLuhan.
You mean how that it was all about McLuhan? That view?
Yeah, in terms of his particular diagnosis of McLuhan was probably the one that was most infectious, for want of a better word.
And what was it in essence?
McLuhan got it all wrong, but he was kind of an interesting guy.
He got it all wrong. The understanding of the significant issues about
Sorry, you're dropping out a little bit, Bob. Connection's a little compromised at the moment.
You think how am I sounding right now?
Right now you're good. We just...
just a little bit. So I was saying that James Carey is saying that Marshall got Innes wrong, or he just got all the issues of Marshall's and Carey's time wrong?
Yeah, I guess he didn't understand Innes. That's always the big point. He says that he pairs McLuhan with the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. What else does he do? It's been a long time since I've thought about Carey.
Well, I saw Carey's mea culpa speech in 99, around the Lance Strait Fordham gang. Mark Stahl and I went to some... Oh, yeah, that was up in the Adirondack Mountains or whatever it is. We went up there for a conference, and James Carey was one of the keynotes, and he was being forced to sort of reassess what he thought Marshall was about because Marshall's second revival started, and more half-understanding people at Marshall were about writing about it, including me. So he had to sort of apologize for what he did, but he still held on. Basically, he held on to his position. He said what bothered him about Marshall is that Marshall would not help Jim Carrey, who was like dean of students or a university professor whose students were being drafted to Vietnam. And I think I've mentioned this to you before. And Marshall would not help him on that issue. And he thought that, look, if you're a teacher concerned about your students, you're going to help them not get drafted in an evil war. And he found Marshall wouldn't help on that level, and he resented that.
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, I guess that's what... his last article, I guess, on McLuhan was Interpreting McLuhan, I think. It's 1999, Journal of Communication. And, he said... Yeah, because he's facing a very different McLuhan, but I think he holds on to that fact that that McLuhan abandoned Innes and yet acquired some legitimacy from it or something like that.
Yeah, no, he in the end, Carey's wrong.
Yeah, and he consistently overplays McLuhan's Catholicism, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Like he props McLuhan up as almost a Puritan, you know, or...
That's right. And this quote that we just got from Nina Sutton's interview in 1975 is new stuff. It's incredible. Where Marshall says he went into the church studying the effects, and he was always studying the effects. He was not a Catholic in any sense of understanding what Catholics are. Someone blindly following a doctrine. He says in this quote he didn't even read the catechism. He had nothing to do with the the doctrine or concepts of being Catholic. And when I was telling that to somebody or they heard the thing, they said, now I can understand why Marshall was the way he was, because I didn't understand how he could – who was telling me this? So Catholic. She said, I couldn't understand how Marshall could fight the way he did and be a Catholic, because they wouldn't think a Catholic would be interested in that kind of stuff. They thought Catholics were Puritans, say. Well, Marshall wasn't that, because he was studying the effects of being a Catholic, and for him, Catholic was all about praying.
Yeah.
And just praying and getting results from it and studying the effects of it. So you can't even take the normal cliche about what a Catholic is with Marshall. He was a guy visiting every culture around, so why not visit the Catholic Church and be a Catholic when you're with the Catholics? And then when you leave and go over to the other building, be that when you're in that building and x-ray that. Yeah, quite convenient.
Well, no, I don't think he ever, like, I think the way that you express it there is like you sense that he put it down, but I don't ever think he put...
Not putting it down. No, he was not limited to being... In other words, he studied the effect. It was one of the institutional effects that he studied.
Yeah, I see, again, I wouldn't say this phrase that he wasn't limited to being. I mean, in essence, it's not a limiting category. It doesn't actually apply in that sort of way. Something about the freedoms McLuhan had in moving in these different environments. And the capacity to engage the church critically and all these other things, but yeah.
Yeah, he developed a new way of being a critical Catholic.
That's, I think, is a really helpful statement.
Yeah.
I mean, he's totally different from the Catholics that would initiate all the anti-censorship lobby and... Oh, it's not. I mean, the actual pro censorship lobby is, and we don't want to watch this film because it hasn't got a happy, cute message in it.
Yeah, he was not part of that game.
No, that's why he seems so different. I mean, in relation to media.
That's right. So, I'm getting a slight echo. Could you adjust your microphone or whatever it was that fixed it the last time?
Okay. Remember, how about that? Yeah,
I'm okay. No, it's very slight.
Is this better?
Okay. I think we're okay. All right, so just leave it there, wherever you position it. So, that works. So we're at this point. So I hope Andrew's listening to what we're doing, because what we're saying here is relevant and never been said before about McLuhan and with this kind of depth about the subtleties and issues around books and Marshall and whether he was for television or not, you know, and the bunker statement that in the end he was trying to preserve books, you know. This is not the whole story. So, okay. People, if you're just talking about the average citizen, yeah, they had no time to understand Marshall's work. They were enjoying the services of the new environment, or alienated by his services. Marshall writes an essay, 75 or so, somewhere's in there, and he ends it by saying, you can be totally ecstatic about our time or totally alienated. You know, either is an effect that you should try to see what's causing it in you.
Yeah.
And so, the average people were just swept up, and why would they need to understand anything? Because Marshall was even studying that. If we can't understand what's happening, you can't have a point of view, and it's difficult to communicate any accurate x-ray of the situation, then we can understand why people are doing what they're doing. And remember, he says in that Time magazine article on him doing the Do Lie newsletter in July 1968, he says, we just do what other people do. You remember that quote? People enjoy hardware, so we'll enjoy it. When in Rome, when I'm in this medium, I do it, and when I go in another medium, I do it.
Yeah.
It's Joyce's maxim: silence, exile, and cunning. That's Marshall, and he even developed that into being happy while doing it.
Yeah.
Okay. Andrew says, I get that about how people were not making the effort to understand Marshall's work. They were too lazy. And he says, it's not easy to get it. But then Marshall was not, okay, it's not easy to get Marshall. Yeah, not easy to get Marshall.
Oh, it's interesting. But, I mentioned, Eric, that I can't understand how people got McLuhan so wrong. And then he goes, I get that. So it's interesting. He's canceling himself.
Yeah. And then he says, it's not easy to get it. And I think I'm taking that sentence to mean it's not easy to understand McLuhan. Basic McLuhan is, hey, when you bring in new technology, it's obvious that it's going to upset your society. As any businessman or heavy responsible manager knows, he said the medium of the message was an aside. It was a reminder. It was a cliche. But the panic culture of the 1970s turned it into an archetype. But it was a practical statement. What you would say to Mr. Trudeau. You wouldn't give him a theory. You wouldn't give him a joke or something. You wouldn't. If Trudeau wanted a serious statement from him, you remind him that, look, all this chaos is due to this new media. It's obvious.
Want to win the war? Get the new tank.
Yeah. So what's interesting is how then Marshall, because the authorities understood that and couldn't be hanging around Marshall, they had to handle the problem, and it was a pretty hectic time, and still is. What's Marshall going to do in the meantime? He's going to make art and then relate it back to Finnegan's Wake and the history of poetry and resume whittling. You know, it's making books that appear to complexify. But you know what it was?
Dialogue on the sidelines. A dialogue on the sidelines to distract.
He says that. He knew that because the medium was the message, that there was such a complex society that intelligence agencies ran the scene and made sure he blew up the world. He says in 1951, June 22nd, I will create a dialogue on the sidelines. The establishment was had big issues, and they had to deal with the cyborgian reality and not the people.
Yeah, it's odd that we've never seen a study of McLuhan as a peacemaker.
Yeah, you say you've never seen that?
Yeah, not in essence, or not anybody who's looked at it explicitly.
Well, he was trying to make bridges. That's the opening themes in Take Today. I mean, he was trying to make bridges. That's how I understand peacemaking.
Yes.
Take Carmen's ends, they became what they beheld, or he begins, they became what they beheld, with the line, only connect. That means make a bridge, but it's not a simple thing of making a literal animal connection.
Yeah.
So, and it's not about matching, but it's interesting that Marshall's books were about the medium. And the medium was the message. I'm going to write books about literary culture and media culture, which is all the old, which is being threatened by the satellite hidden ground. Trudeau and them know about that. They'll handle that. On the sideline, I will discuss the medium. And the medium was the past artifacts. And so then he made complex thought patterns about the old environments. Now, that's pretty good. As the Evergreen said once to me, to sum up Marshall's work, he showed how you could use the past to explain the future. Now, if you think the definition of the medium is, it's the past. It's what the society already has given. And the future is the new technologies, which, if you understand what the past is a guide to the circumstances the effect of the poem will engage.
Yeah. The new is anti-environmental before it becomes environmental.
Yes. Okay, so McLuhan, didn't he say he understand the media in Israeli, in Jewish literature? You state the solution in the first paragraph.
I don't know.
That's a statement. Understanding media. He comments on how the solution is stated right off. They don't waste around making a case, but then they then spend many pages talking about, I don't know, the effect of having stated this solution. So Marshall said the solution right away. The medium is message. That's it. Very easy. And now I'll make a neat book for you, which will be based on cartoons. And it'll be a battle of the newspaper and television over the advertising dollar.
Cut and paste.
Yeah, and move towards getting that Broadway musical going. Okay, so I will not quote from Annie Hall, says Andrew, at least not today. This says it well. Now,
You skipped the whole paragraph.
Beg your pardon? Oh, did I?
Yeah.
Okay.
I get that. It's not easy to get it. But then Marshall was not interested in making anything easy to understand. And why should he? He worked hard to develop his theories. His books were laboriously composed and revised endlessly. So he made and makes you work to understand. Dots, dots, dots. And I think one feels more satisfied to achieve something with hard work rather than having it handed to them. It did, however, cause a lot of grief for him. But you know what? Good for him for not making it easy.
Okay, that's all. It's 10% correct. Because Marshall was not interested, he says, was not interested in making anything easy to understand. No. He wanted the Kissingers to understand that he knew their dilemma. Right? He wanted to make those that were in charge of the huge mega environments, he was interested in making it easy for them and to remind them. But starting the dialogue on the sidelines was for the majority of the world audience. You don't want to be a Kissinger. You don't want to be a harassed bureaucrat there dealing with these awesome responsibilities. McLuhan used to make fun of it. He called it the blowing both horns of your dilemma. Since the modern electric media allowed the teacher to talk to so many millions of people, not just the students in his class, he jumped into the global classroom. And yes, within that context, for that audience, he wanted to make them think. He even says in 1966 when the early pressure was on him to explain himself after sort of a bit of a success with Understanding Media and before the hoopla of 67, the New York Times says, McLuhan admits it. He just wants to make us think. And so everybody, oh, okay, he's just another guy trying to make us think.
Yeah,
in other words, they detected the put-on. Okay, so he tried to make you – he worked hard to come up with new ways to make you think this about the same issue. His books were laboriously – no, they weren't laboriously composed. They were laboriously edited by the book publishers who Marshall had to fight off, and as Marshall said to me once, he would cut off his left hand to make sure they left a word in. So it was laboriously reacted to. The labor was in calming down the editors.
Yeah, but then again, he turns up with boxes of pages, you know, that are, they're not even in any order.
Okay, so what's your point there? I don't get it.
Whether it's laborious or unlaborious, or whether he'd cut off his hand to save a word, it's a very complex interaction with his publishers.
Yeah, one should not write anything about McLuhan. You should just say, hey, jump in. There's room for anybody, because every statement is limited and doesn't help. And you need to point that out more than anything, so that this is not accurate, what Andrew's saying here. It's a contribution, but it requires response. And he worked hard to develop his theories. They weren't theories, right? But for literary people, they were theories, but they weren't theories. In other media, his books were laboriously composed and revised. No, they were hodgepodges and... you could hardly get cliched archetype finished, and it wasn't perfected. Cultures Our Business was hacked up by the editors.
Yeah, but by the same token, he labored pretty hard to come to understand his formula by which he would write and compose.
Oh, that was done back in the 30s.
Yeah, way back. And so he did a lot of the hard labor there, and once he got that algorithm from Joyce and from whomever, then he was good to go.
Yeah, and he got others to write the book. Barry Nevitt wrote all of today.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, Marshall would talk, and they would write it down. Or he'd dictate to Mark Stewart. Marshall lived by the dictum that conversation was the most fun, and he was sticking to that for his joy. He's going to do it 24/7. Call up people in the middle of the night so he could enjoy conversation. Pointed conversation. So he made and makes you work to understand. Yeah, that's the symbolist technique and the aphoristic technique. And Marshall forever quoted that Bacon quote that talked about the difference between the aphoristic method and the prose method.
Yeah.
And you would think that, I see, the subtle way to look at it is that Marshall used neither method. He was trying to show the hidden ground of why a literate person would get schizophrenic and have the choice between two modes. That's the deeper way to look at it.
Yeah, well, our age is an aesthete of all other ages. And so that's how you illustrate it.
And he was critiquing that.
Yeah.
Okay, when he ends An Ancient Quarrel in Modern America, where he talks about, look, we can teach grammar and rhetoric in certain grades and then dialectics. He's not anti-dialectics. He knows that it's part of education. He's for the whole trivium.
Well, I mean, in that thesis, he actually says or entertains the possibility that they're, perennial states of the human mind. So that these three are perennial states.
Yes, and he wasn't a rhetorician trying to kill dialectics. He wanted to show why, now we get into formal causality, why formal causality was having a retrieval. Not that he was for formal causality, he just knew that was the new retrieved dynamic that was being evoked by the electric age, and he was an early man to see that, so he applied that, you could say. He applied formal causality, hooked it up as a method, because he knew he'd get attention that way.
We're sort of circling around a question that I've been struggling with for a couple of years now that I never know quite how to answer, is this idea of Menippean silence and whether it's full or empty. You know, and there's a lot of debate when you're talking about McLuhan, is there anything left once you scratch it all away, you know, the inarticulatable message kind of thing, or is the actual Menippean silence actually pretty, it's a void?
Okay, see, though, you're naming concepts. When you have noise, okay, you look at some of his talks in the mid-60s where he's talking about John Cage's book Silence, and he's actually talking about silence in a way people don't think of it. He said, silence is the unattended noises in the environment, the things not noticed, not the absence of sound. They were the hidden ground. So the whole meaning of silence is made richer and deeper by the way Marshall talks about the concept of silence that John Cage names his famous book after. And so in a world, and doesn't he say in a later interview, we're here watching society program the noise? No, he says we can program the noises. So all these bleedings and blatherings and effects and noise of the information society could be programmed, and one of the methods was the interval of silence or turn off the media temporarily. So the reason you can't get a definite answer on that dialectic is that he was exploring that and the simulation of silence, because we lived in an environment of silence in the sense of so many noises turned into, what's the word, white noise. So he was certainly you would explore that quadriphenically, that question, as he was.
Yeah, well, it certainly hasn't rendered a ready answer to me nor a whole lot of other people, you know, who approach it in the sense of whether they're trying to find a positive message behind the Menippeans or whether they actually find the Menippean spirit is actually purely destructive.
In different contexts, you know, something that is not welcome in another context is welcome. So it depends on the context where something that might be rude or antisocial sometimes is useful. So knowing that the context changes for a Menippean action, and the Menippean action, as Eric says in his thesis, cannot be defined. It's what is intuited as an awakening gesture or a ironic or humor-evoking gesture is the Menippean impulse.
So we do have to understand circumstance, Bob. Relative to effects.
Yeah, I think he defines in one of his early essays, he says, art is always the same about the condition of man, but the conditions for art always change.
Yeah.
Put in the word Menippean satire there. The conditions for Menippean satire always change. Or the manipulations of evoking the conditions for evoking silence always change. But there is always the eternal dilemma of being human, or the eternal satisfaction of being human.
Yeah, I can go with that. Well, let's continue.
Okay, so I'm glad you went over this last paragraph. There was a lot there that shouldn't be missed. He says, I think one...
So we're up to now, I will not quote from Annie Hall, at least not today.
Then he says, this says it well, but before we go into it, I just want to look. It did, however, cause a lot of grief for him. Well, he was into suffering, and I don't think that sometimes, I mean, he told me that he was very tired of explaining visual space and the acoustic space in the late 70s. You know, he wanted to get into tactile space and people realized he's talking about other spaces. So it was the burden of people trying to understand and only gotten to the kindergarten level, and he had to keep talking to them about that. That's just boredom. It's not necessarily grief, but he had time, a lot of time by himself to enjoy making new patterns. I mean, basically, I saw McLuhan as having a happy life.
Yeah, I mean, grief's not all bad, and I'm sure that there's aspects of being a teacher which certainly would have got to him on a daily basis. You know, you can't...
It's a normal frustration. That very audio that we play from the Finnish person that's featured when you click on our site, you hear McLuhan sighing as he talks to the guy. I don't know if I'm hearing it right, but he's bored with the guy he's talking to. Or irritated. And you notice how he cuts it off. He stops it.
Yeah.
It's when the guy started waxing about how war is irrelevant. And the guy doesn't have any clue of what Marshall's talking about. He's putting value judgments on war and that. And shortly after that, Marshall stops it. If it was stopped at that point, it's edited that way. So he made stuff hard to understand so people would get all worked up and frustrated so it would give him grief so he could suffer and be a true Christian.
I don't know about that, but it's a great probe.
Okay, so Sam Neill, this quote we're going to read, he showed up in the 80s. Yeah, it was after McLuhan was gone. Showed up in the 80s and did a little talk. And wasn't aware of any book he was doing. But he was like an old codgety guy who he was probably told to be a librarian. And the main point I got from his warning, his talk was to all these academics and McLuhanites that were there and the coachos, was realize McLuhan was writing poetry. It was a poem. Do not try to explain it. Do not try to almost understand it. He said, that's what you got to get. Now, I don't necessarily agree with it, but that's what he said in the 80s. So now let's go back and see what he wrote in 1971.
Hey, I've got a review of what he wrote right here in front of me.
A review of what?
So this is Abstract Books of Marshall McLuhan, Sam Neill. He also wrote Clarifying McLuhan. He wrote a whole book published in 1993, yeah?
Right, he was taught. I had an intuition he was doing a book back in the 80s, but I never saw it. So yeah, you have the book?
No, I've got my notes on it. Like, I've got notation from that.
Okay, so what do you think his punchline is about Clarifying McLuhan?
Well, it's the last, it's a really odd book, actually, because it's the last one, it's the last book before the cyber culture hits. So right. It's really talking about McLuhan, an 80s vision of McLuhan, yet it's published in 93, so it's a little bit really weird. And so he specifically sets out to reframe McLuhan for those hypnotized by McLuhan's rhetoric and not able to check his sources. So he's all about this idea McLuhan is a little bit charlatan, he's using his sources in for nefarious means. And he does what he presents what he calls a stereoscopic portrait. So he's looking through two lenses. He looks through what he calls a normative frame, which is McLuhan as failed sociologist, theorist, and all that sort of thing. And he also looks at McLuhan as the, in quotes, the serious artist he claims to be.
Oh, so he says, Sam says that he's a failed sociologist?
No, no, he's saying he's looking through a normative frame, essentially. So it's what he considers normative scholarship at the time. And within that...
Okay, but you said failed sociologist. What's that mean?
Well, no, I was just abridging the fact that, I mean, that's essentially his punchline. Is that within the normative frame, McLuhan appears as the perpetrator of a fallacy, disinterested in polishing his arguments and lacking intellectual rigor, clarity, consistency.
Okay, that's a lot of concepts about McLuhan going and telling Kissinger the medium is the message,
yeah,
and reminding him you don't need to complexify it. And see, so the two lenses are, there's McLuhan, the active citizen, engaging with people verbally because you can go fly and meet them, whereas, you know, 100 years ago he just wrote them letters. And then there's the McLuhan who makes books, and they should be split, separated. And he's dealing with the person who writes books and talking about the concepts that the book evokes from that. And he says here in this quote, McLuhan's concern for the future of the book, we can see him as one who has perhaps a greater perception of the value of books and libraries for civilization than many librarians. Now Sam Neill may be a librarian. He's writing for the Library Quarterly. He's promoting the book thing. And this is not accurate, as we've spelled out already. So I predict that Sam Neill doesn't get it on the level we're talking. So are you going to read a quote or two or something?
Yeah, no, he doesn't get it. And so,
but Andrew is citing it for his not getting it perspective.
Yeah, no, this is, Sam Neill is a big time not getting it. Because even like as an artist, he'll say, where do we go? Even if, you know, consider it as on his own terms, as a serious artist he claims to be, this account sort of terminates in the claim that McLuhan is an artist of limited scope who may not have produced anything beyond grotesques, in brackets I've got the metaphoric tetrads, that make us think about media. So he's saying, well, look, even if he's an artist, he's a pretty budget B-grade artist, and he made us think, and that's it.
Yeah, so Sam Neill is a POB, an old-fashioned humanist, concerned about Gutenberg issues like what's science and what's art, and never knew that Marshall was a new kind of artist, a new kind of scientist, x-raying the old institutions of art and science, even the most modern art and science. So he had no clue what Marshall's art was about.
No, not at all. I mean, his work, in a sense, sort of rings a little bit... how would you say? There's a contemporary ring to it insofar as cultural studies at the moment seems to be taking on Havelock. And that's the grounds on which Neill takes on McLuhan within this normative frame. This idea that McLuhan's whole theory of... his basic theory of psychic transformation as a result of media impact does not hold and is invalidated.
Right. And Mark Derry spoke at the McLuhan conference. He's a pretty hip writer and all this stuff in the 90s. He concluded that Marshall was a racist because he wrote about the African and, you know, quoting those studies by J.C. Carruthers. And
yep.
I mean, it's within the political correctness or whatever of the 80s, but it's silly. They don't even know that Marshall wasn't even in the writing. These were words put together by someone who should not be identified with the words.
Yeah. I mean, this is that was Don's major criticism, isn't it? Is that these people don't know anything about what happened in art or literature in the 20th century.
Yeah, they don't know about how the way Mallarmé, you know, took the person, the writer, out of the poem.
Yeah, they're still thinking that biography is still important.
Yeah, so what's interesting with Sam Neill, he's he's interesting because he actually reads the books, McLuhan's books, one of the few people reading them and thinking about them. That's why it's interesting to read, but thinking too much about the books misses some points. These people are people who watched McLuhan from the distance. They didn't have the guts to come and hang out at the coach house and find out what really was going on.
Yeah, this guy's mechanical in terms of the the way he underpins McLuhan is by going into all his sources, and so he'll say that Okay, McLuhan's sources on the Orient, namely The Book of Tea by Okakura Kakuzo, or The Chinese Eye by Chang Yi, Ruth Benedict, they're all wrong. And then he'll go after Krugman, says Krugman's all wrong. He says that T.S. Eliot was kind of messed up, Popper was messed up. And so, like, to destroy McLuhan, he just takes on this whole cluster of...
He thinks that Marshall believes in the sources. Marshall was cutting and pasting whatever he could get somebody talking approximately about media research that Marshall could prop up to make a different point than those guys. He actually was showing. Marshall was quoting these people's statements about the Asia and that to show their own bias. And he knew they were wrong. And he was showing that the reason they got attention was Electric Age made those figures... resonant. That's the real thing. Marshall was quoting those and saying these new developments in the 50s by Ruth Benedict and how they learned from an anthropology about fatty community was a product of the electric effect. Finney's Wake was a knee-jerk response to radio. He wasn't citing these things as authorities that Marshall worshipped. They were figures for ground that Sam doesn't even see Marshall's trying to illustrate. That's why Marshall would grab anything from anywhere, whether it was right or not, because it's overall the content that the authors he would grab were pointing to a new perception that those authors did not know were evoked by the electric age. You get that?
Yeah, totally.
That's what he missed. And so being a librarian, I don't know why I think he's a librarian. Either he said it, and it's, I'm reminded by the fact he's writing for the Library Quarterly. But if he was a librarian, he had lots of time to look at all the books that were cited by McLuhan. Well, he worked at the library.
Yeah. I mean, he's certainly had a lot of time to read.
Okay, so we understand the limitations. And I always wish, you know, too bad Sam isn't here to get mad at us and argue with us. Then we quote back to him and show where he got the wrong sources.
Yeah, he's actually, Sam, I'm glad you raised it. He's in my top five books of most ridiculous books about McLuhan of all time.
Okay. All right, so I think we're coming to an end. I have to stop soon, so let's just see how this ends. I remember some years ago, The Estate, says Andrew, was approached by the For Dummies book people do. Was approached by the For Dummies book people to do a McLuhan For Dummies book. My grandmother, Corinne, refused, and rightly so. McLuhan's not for people who want easy answers. Sanctioning a, quote, For Dummies book would be an insult to Marshall's memory work. Okay. In Richard Castellanos' article on McLuhan, New York Times, about January 67, McLuhan says, in these difficult times, these upsetting, you know, chaotic times, people need concepts, at least to get a temporary grip on reality. The use of the book was service. I just figured out what the service is. He knew that his process would be interpreted as theories and concepts, and he knew the average confused citizen would find these useful to think and talk about and distract them from their anxieties. He knew that it could be seen as an easy answer, and that was a nice anesthetic to do. That was one of the levels he was servicing. He did want his stuff to be easy answers for people to understand why change was happening. And it was an easy answer. Hey, the television did it to your kids. Look at what television is. It was an easy answer. And for those people... the hoi polloi who were trying to figure out why their kids were different or why society didn't turn out the way they thought it would be, he provided the answer. So, you know, this is limited to say that point.
So he also, is it a poke at McLuhan for McLuhan for Beginners? You know, that's Terence Gordon's book.
Right. Am I poking at it?
I'm just saying, like, is a McLuhan for Dummies a McLuhan for Beginners? You know, Is he taking a poke at Terrence or what?
I don't know, but Terrence, that's the reason Terrence got the job as a biographer. He did some kind of explaining McLuhan book that Corinne and Eric noticed, and they liked what he did. I think it was the Understanding McLuhan, you know, in that series of Understanding Everybody, those Understanding books, those quickie books that came out in the mid-90s. I think that's what he... Terrence has done a couple of sort of Understanding book. Anyways, the point is that when you then got relaxed by reading McLuhan, if you dared to stumble into the coach house, go to a Monday night thing, then you'd find the difficulty and realize, well, yeah, we got easy answers here, but there's more than that operating around the quadriphenic McLuhan environment. And then maybe then you'd be puzzled. But McLuhan, for one level, he was, look at the Ecclesiastes archetype. He talks about the you done it. And he talks about Lewis and, I don't know if there's a Joyce book, but a lot of popular books. I remember one, Gods and Scholars. Books that people found easy answers from or interesting different perspectives, but it kind of calmed them down, like the Wyndham Lewis's Time and Western Man. He called it a you done it. It was a put on to make you think that you were significant, had an input. It's like the bottom-up level of the conditioning of reality or the creating of reality. So Marshall's books were you done it.
Yeah, I'm totally. I mean, isn't that the punchline of all Manipian satire?
Yes,
that
yes,
it's you, the audience, the reader, that.
And that's it. That can be an easy answer because more and more of the environment looked like you didn't do it. You know, the Android meme did it.
Yeah.
So you had to come up with new ways to make people realize that there was a you that might be a factor in causation. You think of the quote that's used in. And whatever her name was, that did the play on McLuhan in 94 in New York that I saw and was an advisor to, her, Ann Bogart was her name maybe, she had McLuhan going around, you don't like those ideas? I got a lot of others for you. That's McLuhan. You don't like that level? Let's go to this level. You want an easy answer? I'll give it to you. You don't want an easy answer? I can give you a non-easy answer involving process also. I'm here to serve you on any level you want to start.
Yeah.
Okay, so he says, he ends by saying, for my part, I didn't always understand that. I thought for a long time about a project to translate McLuhan so that people could more easily understand his work. We immediately think of how Don did that for CBC, and McLuhan got mad at him for making Marshall easy. Now, what's interesting is that he knew Don could explain a lot that Marshall didn't want out for a certain audience, before he could get out and mystify. He didn't want Don to stop the dialogue, which would be caused by McLuhan presenting some mysterious new perceptions that would get people puzzled and talking and make them think. So he didn't want to be translated too early, but he didn't mind being translated in other contexts. That's what Barry Nevert did. Barry Nevert was a translator of McLuhan. You read his books, he's defining the basic percepts and explaining things.
I love Barry's books. They're great.
They're very good for an introduction to understanding Marshall.
Yeah.
Or the first level of understanding. I thought for a long time about a project to translate McLuhan so that people could more easily understand his work. Not only was this highly presumptuous on my part, if I could actually pull such a thing off, it would probably take most of my lifetime. It would be the equivalent of writing McLuhan for dummies. At the time, though, I thought it was a way to make McLuhan more accessible, which is actually another way of saying dumbing it down. Now, I hope Andrew listens to this, because Eric should be critiquing what his son is writing here and explaining other levels like I'm doing and you're doing. So we're here to make Andrew for dummies. This is Andrew for dummies. And it includes us, too.
Yeah, no, I'm an Andrew and I'm a dummy, so yeah, that's fine.
Oh, yeah, I didn't mean you. I mean Andrew McLuhan. We're all dummies, as McLuhan said. We're all mute, dumb, and some other word. What is it? Can't speak, say, or see. Dumb, and blind in this situation.
Well, moot, dumb, and jute, I guess.
Moot, dumb, and what?
Jute. Or jut. Who's the other caveman in
Finland? Oh, yeah, yeah, Mutt and Jute.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. Mute and Jet. Hey, that's good. I hadn't seen that. Okay, understanding the work of Marshall McLuhan is not easy, but it is rewarding. Yes, coming to understand the concept of figure and ground, which I'm told came from the concept of center width without margin from economics, has made me see the world in different ways. Coming to view media as environments kind of blew my mind. Now, it's interesting that one doesn't see that. And is it because his generation doesn't see media as environments? Why does he mean media as environments? Because to see reality through figure and ground is visual bias. Tribal people don't see figure and ground.
Yeah, they see both simultaneously, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot to say right there. He hasn't even begun to understand what Marshall helped him see.
probably actually even to say they see both simultaneously is a visual apprehension of a tribal way of thinking, as opposed to engaging the full, what would you call them, all the analogical mirrors.
The simultaneity of the effect of electric life.
The simultaneity, comprehensive, multimodal...
nuance.
Flip-flopping of all those things at once.
It's what Marshall said to Innes. It's not amplitude modulation. It's frequency modulation.
Yeah.
That's March 15th, 1951, I think that was written. March 14th or 15th in the letters. So he says, just a side note of my use of addressing my father's Eric or Dad. I know I've been consistent, not been consistent with this, and I'm still not sure which to use. Dad is right to me, as that's what I call him. But Eric is more appropriate, perhaps, in this context. I'll probably continue to use both. Because a blog, now it's interesting, the blog is personal. If you're writing a book or an essay, it's formal. You would say Eric. But actually, he is slipping into the personal dynamic where he's Dad, because the blog medium makes you feel intimate and personal. So he should talk about his dilemma, applying McLuhan, is check the medium you're using for creating the oscillation between whether you use Dad or Eric. Right, yeah, there.
Well, I mean, the blog is, in a sense, a self-invasion of privacy. So
yeah. So it's actually, you say Eric for a certain one level of armor and Dad for another level of armor, because you've invaded yourself on both levels.
Yeah, okay, so he's speaking out of both sides of his mouth, which is, I guess, what we all do now under these contemporary conditions.
Yeah, that's why psychiatry resorted to drugs. The analysis of schizophrenia became obsolete, so you just keep the schizoids going, because everybody with schizophrenia now, which is literary effect, has content, so give them drugs to keep them going. Keep them kinesthetic and synesthetic.
Yeah, and that was that thing that McLuhan was saying to Ong was his great achievement in terms of forging his persona before he embarked on this whole thing.
Okay, do that again. He told him how he was forging his persona?
Yeah, to speak out of both sides of his mouth at once.
Oh, he says that to Ong.
Yeah, now everybody does it.
And then they watch the android meme simulate that and speak out of both sides of his mouth back to itself. And in the last decade, was the era of silence because he had a president who couldn't speak?
Mm. Maybe we've just come to a new understanding of Pied Piper's all. With all those trumpets there.
What would that be to you?
Well, we've had blowing both sides of our dilemma, but if we've got speaking out of both sides of your mouth and having that squared and then squared again.
Yeah, thousands of trumpets leads to silence.
Or more specifically, six trumpets.
Okay, that gets into noise and then the end environment of silence. So... I'm going to leave you with that, Andrew. I'm very happy with what we've done. I didn't know we'd get this much out of the blog.
Oh, that's December, and we've still got January, February, and March to go.
Yeah, but we got a lot. I'm very, very going to be very happy to send this to Andrew.
Yep, I suspect we're going to come across as sounding like total assholes, and I guess on my behalf, I both apologize and don't apologize for that.
Well, let's see.
I mean, who does this, Bob? Who talks about somebody's blog and then critiques it?
Yeah, nobody.
We're so out of touch with our times in that respect. It's wild.
Yeah, why aren't we tweeting about ourselves? Why are we talking with someone else? Why are we actually listening?
In fact, for hours. We've talked about it for hours.
Yeah. Well, about being an asshole, of course, that's the McLuhan tradition. What is it? A gurkok. We're giving jerks a bad name.
Somebody's going to look on the timeline and they're going to find out, wow, shit, that Andrew guy, he was on there for 3 hours, and that Bob was on for 3 hours, and plus all the time. How long did you do on tailgate?
5.5 hours.
Total or 5.5?
The tape is, I think, 4 or 5 hours, so... I did 5 hours, you could say, of the afternoon. I've been talking with McLuhan Quadrant for 8 hours.
Yeah. I can already see how this goes. Like Andrew's going to say to Eric, and Eric will say in his quiet, nice, humble way, "Addicted to speech. Addicted to speech." And that'll be it.
Yeah, they need a dose of Macaulay. Yeah, but the our silence meets their silence.
Okay, well, on that, I'll say thanks very much for the opportunity to dialogue, Bob. Always a pleasure. Lovely to learn some new things and to see things in a different way. And
here's the answer. We were the first to break into the silent sea created by Andrew McLuhan's blog.
Well, a small sea, but we've made it much larger.
Okay, great. Well, it was a pleasure. Looking forward to doing the rest.
Cool. Thanks, Bob. I'm just pressing stop. Where's the stop button? Oh, I'll just hang up, and I guess we'll talk later.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Cheers,
bye.
Bob.
Bye.